Most of you know quite a bit about Nora Vincent. I'll just quickly say she holds a bachelor's degree in philosophy from Williams College and lives in New York City. Her essays, columns, and reviews have appeared in the New Republic, the New York Times, the New York Post, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, Chicago Tribune, and many more regional papers around the country. She wrote the higher ed column for the Village Voice from 1999 to 2001, and also wrote a weekly column, biweekly column for Salon.com. Most recently, as a syndicated columnist, she wrote a weekly piece for the LA Times op-ed page and wrote a quarterly politics and culture column for the magazine The Advocate. In 2003, she took a leave from writing her nationally syndicated political opinion columns in order to write her book, Self-Made Man, and she is now touring for the paperback release of that best-selling book. Please join me in welcoming Nora Vincent.
Thank you. Thanks for coming out. I'm going to read you the harsh chapter, so I hope this won't be too harsh. And if there's anybody who's sensitive to harsh language, you might want to leave now. This is my sex chapter where I went to the strip clubs as Ned. Okay. The four F's. That's all you need to know about women. Find them, feel them, fuck them, and forget them. Phil, a 33-year-old professional with a wife and two daughters, was telling me about the first and only man-to-man chat he ever had with his father. He was 12 years old at the time, and that was the only advice he ever got from anyone about how to treat a lady. I had met him as Ned for the first time at another bar a few nights before, struck up a conversation with him, and asked if he could show me where the good strip clubs were in the area. He'd agreed. So here we were at the Lizard Lounge, sitting at the back of a dark room at one of those square brown formica tables that you see in truck stop coffee shops, the kind with the rickety bases that always have a matchbook shoved under one of their feet and filthy plastic ashtrays sliding back and forth across their tops in a rash of salt. The room was filled with tables like this, set up cafe style, all with their metal frame chairs turned in the same direction, and the men in them staring rapt at the naked women dancing for them on the stage. Other naked women were wandering around the tables, working the crowd for dollar bills, a wad of which they each had strapped around one ankle. Phil had ordered a bottle of water, as had I. They didn't serve alcohol at the Lizard Lounge, which is common in places where the girls get totally naked on stage and give the more explicit private lap dances. In the places where alcohol is served, the dancers don't usually disrobe entirely, and if lap dances are offered, they're usually of the tamer variety, where touching isn't allowed and nothing more than frottage happens. That is, unless you find a place that's breaking the rules, which a lot of places do to some extent or another, depending on what an individual dancer is willing to do off stage. Phil poured his water into a glass, then dumped two packets of sugar into the water and stirred it with a straw. He gulped it as he spoke. My dad and I have come to places like this together, he said. We have a lot of fun with it. He came to my bachelor party here and he got a couple of lap dances. This appalled me at first, the idea of a father and a son hanging out in strip clubs together as if it were a rite of passage. It appalled me even more that a father would advise his son to treat women like hostile organisms who were to be made necessary and expedient use of and then discarded as soon as possible. But the more I observed about the painful compulsions of male sexuality while in the company of men as a man, and the more I understood about the deep insecurity that goes along with being a man in the company of women, the more I understood what a ham-handed charade men were often putting on in front of each other, all of it in a desperate effort to hide that insecurity and pain. My bowling pals had been as full of the same off-color jokes as Phil and his dad, full of the same know-it-all insouciance that betrayed exactly how much, not how little, women and the esteem of women actually meant to them. We'd only been at the club for a few minutes, just long enough for Phil to spin his family anecdote, when one of the naked crowd pleasers approached me. I looked at the floor as if to decline her offer, but it wasn't an offer. This was my first time in a strip club, and I didn't know the etiquette yet. I didn't know that giving dollars to the dancers wasn't really elective. You were pretty much expected to give on demand, which is why the doorman had given me 8 singles in change for my 20. The dancer turned her back to Phil's gummy grin as she slipped between our chairs to face me. She took my right knee between her legs and sidled her pelvis closer to my face. I looked up past eye level, trying not to see the hard, veined hands that were already roughly parting and fingering her shaved pussy. I looked past the length of her stretched belly and her small, angry breasts to her downturned face, which I thought would be the least offensive part of her. But I was wrong. Her face was where the squalor showed the most. She looked old for this work, but she was probably younger than she looked. She peered down at me with a weathered grimace of contempt and resignation, like a prostitute posing for a mugshot. And who could blame her? We were the scum in her world, and a dollar didn't merit effort. She was giving us what we wanted, and she was giving it dirty. She wasn't pretending that she liked us or wanted us or cared what we thought. She knew what we thought. Her face didn't matter. Probably only a woman would even bother with her face. None of the other guys I saw her approach ever looked her in the eye, and I only did it out of shame and disgust. I had thought I would find something endurable in that face, but it was a mask. Her eyes were intentionally repulsive, and I looked away. What had I expected? She knew that no matter how raunchy things got, the men would want more of it. They would look at the gash in front of them with the mild interest of entitlement, which the men around me did. They turned their eyes sideways from the stage to look at her impassively as if she were a commercial break or a side of fries. I shoved my dollar at her just to get rid of her, but she wouldn't take it. "Not yet," she said. She could tell I was a cherry and she was going to amuse herself with my discomfort. She leaned over and took my head between her hands. She pulled me into her chest, sagging one meager breast on each cheek, then bobbling them back and forth with her shoulders. Maybe she was genuinely smiling now. Finally, she pulled her ankle up into my lap, digging the point of her heel into my knee and bending open the wadded bills so that I could reach in and deposit my due. "Now," she said. This was my introduction to a substratum of the male sexual psyche that most women either don't know about, don't want to know about, or both. How could they? Their boyfriends and husbands weren't likely to tell them, not even about things they did when they were bachelors. There is too much shame in it, or more truthfully, there is too much incrimination. If a man has been to a place like this and admits it, he's already blemished in the eyes of many prospective mates. And if he admits to having enjoyed it or indulged his baser instincts in the corners of the room, he's even more tainted, which is why the men I met were never honest with the women in their lives about strip joints like these or the sexual drives they are designed to satisfy. Phil knew these drives and their offerings intimately, and he liked playing the guide and tutor. He knew I'd never been to a place like this before, and when I asked him probing questions about it, he was full of expert bluster about what it all meant, as if by virtue of being who he was, a prototypical guy, he had a lock on the male mind. What are most guys looking for in a woman? We're not looking for a nice person. We're not looking for someone to rear our children. We're not looking for someone who's going to pitch in and be a good worker and contribute to the household. A guy is looking for a woman to fuck him. We want someone we can stick our dicks in all the time. That's 95% of looking for a woman, and there's no explaining that to anyone. Of course, I'd spoken to enough men to know that this wasn't the whole truth by any means, and Phil knew it too. But it was a truth of sorts. Plenty of men, most really, want wives and families for all the right and good reasons, for love, companionship, dedication. Domesticity is not inimical to them. The very idea is absurd and disproved 1,000 times a day. But to hear them tell it, a lot of men do seem to struggle with their sexuality underneath, as well as all the religious, political, matrimonial, literally mothering forces that tell them to repress it. Men get married, but their sexuality doesn't then magically disappear amid the bliss of family life. Hence the preponderance of married men loping off in shame and secret to the strip club. Sometimes even respectable men with respectable lives have primal, ugly stuff bracketed somewhere in their minds, kept in its place apart from the purported love that goes with the responsibilities of fatherhood and husbanding. How could it be otherwise? Much as they might have liked them to, these drives and desires didn't somehow cease to exist in respectable company. It was only society's prevailing myth, or perhaps female wish fulfillment, that had pretended otherwise. As a result, individual men and women were left to sort out the sordid reality on their own, hurting and getting hurt because sometimes it was too hard to successfully resolve the conflict between baseline male sexuality and the civilized role of a man. These clubs and the thoughts and feelings that produce them are the squalid sub-basement of male sexuality, in which a lot of men have at least one foot or toe firmly planted. No matter how high they ascend in the civilized world, no matter how tall, how dapper, how educated or savvy they stand in the stratosphere of age and accomplishment, a lot of average guys still have a nudie film loop flickering in the back of their minds. And the more educated, politicized, refined they become, the more ashamed of their base proclivities they often feel. Even the mildest, most conscientious men I spoke to about their sexualities often spoke of the satyr inside them that led them, especially when they were young and crazed by the primal drive to fuck, to do things they were ashamed of. In college, I remember waking up in bed with women I didn't know and worse didn't want to know, said Ron, an Ivy-educated literary family man who makes his living in the world of letters, and feeling so appalled by what my body had led me into doing. Most of these women I just dropped without ceremony, and to this day I feel quite bad about that. I treated them terribly, but I just felt insanely compelled by the urge to find some relief. Despite not wanting to know the truth about what goes on at strip clubs, most women think they know nonetheless. Popular films show women half-clad, shaking it suggestively on stage, which some of them do in the tamer clubs, but the women in these first few clubs I visited were naked, and there was nothing artful about their striptease. There was no tease, just cunt, bald and raw. The women on stage were usually naked within the first minute, and they didn't hint at some dreamed-of consummation. They just auctioned their merchandise at close range. That's just a little bit of a flavor of the strip chapter, and I'm going to go a little lighter on you. This is my bowling chapter where I got started and made some friends as Ned. It's the beginning of the book. When I told my proudly self-confessed trailer trash girlfriend that Ned was joining a men's bowling league, she said by way of advice, "Just remember that the difference between your people and my people is that my people bowl without irony." Translation, hide your bourgeois flag or you'll get the smugness beaten out of you long before they find out you're a woman. People who play in leagues for money take bowling seriously, and they don't take kindly to journalists infiltrating their hard-won social lives, especially when the interloper in question hasn't bowled more than five times in her life, and then only for a lark. But my ineptitude and oddball status notwithstanding, bowling was the obvious choice. It's the ultimate social sport, and as such, it would be a perfect way for Ned to make friends with guys as a guy. Better yet, I wouldn't have to expose any suspicious body parts or break a heavy sweat and risk smearing my beard. Still, in practice, it wasn't as easy as it sounded. Taking that first step through the barrier between Ned, the character in my head, and Ned, the real guy among the fellas, proved to be more jarring than I could have ever imagined. Any smartly dressed woman who has ever walked the gauntlet of construction workers on lunch break or otherwise found herself suddenly alone in unfamiliar male company with her sex on her sleeve will understand a lot of how it felt to walk into that bowling alley for the first time on men's league night. Those guys may not have known that I was a woman, but the minute I opened the door and felt the air of that place waft over me, every part of me did. My eyes blurred in panic. I didn't see anything. I remember being aware only of a wave of noise and imagined distrust coming at me from undistinguishable faces. Probably only one or two people actually turned to look, but it felt as if every pair of eyes in the place had landed on me and stuck. I'd felt a milder version of this before in barbershops or auto body shops, this palpable unbelonging that came of being the sole female in an all-male environment. And the feeling went right through my disguise and my nerve and told me that I wasn't fooling anyone. This was a men's club, and men's clubs have an aura about them, a mostly forbidding aura that hangs in the air. Females tend to respond to it viscerally as they are meant to. The unspoken signs all say, no girls allowed, and keep out, or more idly, enter at your own risk. As a woman, you don't belong, you're not wanted, and every part of you knows it and is just begging to get up and leave. And I nearly did leave, even though I'd only made it two steps inside the door and hadn't even been able to look up yet for fear of meeting anyone's eyes. After standing there frozen for several minutes, I had just about worked up the gumption to retreat and call off the whole thing when the league manager saw me. "Are you Ned?" he asked, rushing up to me. "We've been waiting for you." He was a tiny, wizened stick figure with a five-day growth of stubble on his chin, a crew cut to match, a broken front tooth, and a black watch cap. I had called earlier in the week to find out about the league, and he'd told me what time to show up and which guy to ask for when I got there. I was late already, and my nervous hesitations had made me later. Yeah, I croaked, trying to keep my voice down and my demeanor unshaken. Great, he said, grabbing me by the arm. Come on and get yourself some shoes and a ball. Okay, I said, following his lead. There was no getting out of it now. He walked me over to the front desk and left me there with the attendant who was helping another bowler. As I stood waiting, I was able for the first time to focus on something beyond myself and my fear of immediate detection. I looked at the rows of cubbyholes behind the desk, all with their familiar red, blue, and white paneled shoes stuffed in them in pairs. Seeing them comforted me a little. They reminded me of the good times I'd always had bowling with friends as a kid, and I felt a little surge of carelessness at the prospect of making a fool out of myself. So what if I couldn't bowl? This was an experiment about people, not sport, and nobody had yet pointed and laughed. Maybe I could do this after all. I'm just going to skip ahead a little bit so you get meet the characters. Jim is my was the teammate that sort of made my life the most comfortable, so he's the person I talk about first. Thankfully, Jim did most of the talking that first night, and with his eyes, he included me in the conversation from the beginning. He had known Bob and Alan for a long time. They had all been playing golf and poker together several times a month for years, and Alan was married to Bob's sister. I was a stranger out of nowhere without any shared work or home life experience to offer, and Jim's social generosity gave me an in. He was a natural comedian and raconteur, easy to listen to and talk to, the most open of the bunch by far, and charming as hell. He told stories of the worst beatings he'd taken in his life, and it sounded like there were quite a few, as if they were parties he'd been privileged to attend. He had a robust sense of his own absurdity and a charming willingness to both assign and ridicule his own role in whatever fate he'd been privy to. Even the most rotten things he'd been handed in life, things that were in no way his fault, things like his wife's ongoing ill health, first cancer, then hepatitis, then cancer again, he took with a surprising lack of bitterness. He never fumed about anything, at least not in front of us. That, it seemed, was a private indulgence. And his only apparent public indulgences were of the physical variety, cigarettes, a few beers out of the case he always brought for the team, and junk food. We all usually ate junk food on those Monday nights, all of us except Bob, who stuck to beer, but let us send his 12-year-old son Alex, who always tagged along on league night next door to the 7-Eleven to buy hot dogs, candy, soda, whatever. We always tipped the kid a little for his services, a dollar here and there, or the change from our purchases. Alex was clearly there to spend some quality time with his dad, but Bob mostly kept him at bay. If we weren't sending him next door to fetch snacks, Bob was usually fobbing him off in some other way with a few extra dollars. He'd encourage him to go and bowl a few practice frames in one of the empty lanes at the end of the alley, or play one of the video games against the back wall. Alex was immature for his age, a chatty kid and a bit of a nudge, always full of trivia questions or rambling anecdotes about some historical fact he'd learned in school. Typical kid stuff, but I couldn't really blame Bob for wanting to keep him occupied elsewhere. If you let Alex hang on your arm, he would, and he'd make you wish you hadn't. Besides, this was men's night out, and most of what we'd be talking about wasn't for kids' ears. I noticed, though, that no one ever tempered his speech when Alex was around. We swore like stevedores, and nobody seemed bothered, including me, that a 12-year-old was within earshot. I can't say that the kid ever aroused any maternal instinct in me. I went along with the make-him-a-man attitude that seemed to prevail at the table. In that sense, Alex and I were on a par in our tutorial on manhood, just doing what was expected of us. I was never mean to him, but I participated heartily when the guys teased him. When he'd been going on for too long about Amerigo Vespucci or something else he'd picked up in social studies, either Jim or Alan would say, "Are you still talking?" And we'd all laugh. Alex always took it well and usually just went right on talking. I got the impression that part of Bob's way of teaching his son how to relate to other men was to throw him in with the wolves and let him find his way by trial and error. He'd learn his place in the pack by seeing what worked and what didn't. If he took harsh insults or beatings in the process, so much the better. It would toughen him up. I'm just going to skip again a little bit here and give you more. Nothing was beyond humor, especially for Jim, but he was a sharp guy, and when he made a joke, he always knew and let you know that he knew what he was doing with a quip. He introduced the most outrageous joke he ever told in my presence with an appropriate caveat. "Okay, this is a really sick joke," he said. "I mean really sick, but it's funny as shit. You want to hear it?" Everyone nodded. "Okay, a child molester and a little girl are walking into the woods." He stopped here to add, "I told you it was really sick." Then he went on, "Anyway, so the little girl says to the child molester, 'Mister, it's getting really dark in here. I'm scared.' And the child molester says, Yeah, well, how do you think I feel? I've got to walk back alone. Jim was at his funniest when it came to women and relations between the sexes. As always, his observations were startlingly astute, and his anecdotal way of framing them drew you in and made you come away rolling. Apropos of nothing, he introduced the topic of women one night with this interjection. You know, if guys could just learn to go without the pussy for a while, they'd get so much shit done. I mean, that's what boxers do when they're training. It keeps them focused for the fight. Go without the pussy and you get strong, man. I mean, I haven't been laid in 2 months and I'm about ready to lift up the corner of the house. This was the kind of thing that just came out of his mouth, out of nowhere. And it used to make me wonder what he might have done with himself if he'd gone to college instead of joining the army at 17. His humor was the ticket to his brain, and you could tell it was whirring at a higher speed than most of the brains around him. He often told stories about his days at school as a kid, stories that confirmed my suspicion that he had a lot going on inside his head that had been beaten out of him on the playground, and that he now knew enough not to share in the wrong company. Here again, though, he was impossibly funny. I was one of those quiet psycho kids, he'd say. I never spoke, I just sat there in the corner. You couldn't provoke me to fight. You'd be poking me with a stick and I wouldn't move. I'd just be sitting there drawing pictures of killing your family. Every now and then, Jim would come out with a word that somebody, either Bob or Alex, would call him on, a word like enable, which Alex wanted to know the meaning of, or cordial, which Jim used to describe his behavior towards someone or other, and which Bob clearly thought was a little too big for britches. In Jim's defense, I said that the word was only 2-2 if you were talking cocktails, which of course only made it worse because it made me sound like an asshole and blew for good whatever class cover or remote coolness I might have gained. Jim salvaged me, though, with a courtesy laugh. Then he went on with his riff about men and women. I mean, take work, for example. I can work with an ugly chick. There's an ugly chick works in my office with me every day, and I'm fine. I do my thing. I can concentrate fine. But every now and again, there's this hot, hot woman who comes into the office, and for the whole time she's there, I'm completely fucked. Everything's out the window. I don't get shit done. All I can do is stare at her like this. He made a dumbfounded expression, mimicking himself in the office, ogling the hot chick. But all joking aside, these guys took their sexuality for what it was. They felt there was no getting around it, so they found ways to work within it, ways that sometimes entailed lying to their wives about going to the odd strip club. One night, Jim was talking about his plans for a ski trip. He wanted to find a location that had good skiing, but he also wanted some lively nightlife. I'd like to find a place that has a good titty bar, he said. Bob chimed in, yeah, count me in on that. I'd definitely up for that. This sparked a short discussion of titty bars and how the married man negotiated them. The ski trip would offer one of the few opportunities for the boys to be boys since their wives weren't coming along. This had to be taken advantage of, since it was clear that at least Bob and Jim's wives had expressly forbidden them to go to strip clubs. Besides, they agreed no vacation would be quite as relaxing without a little skin in it. For these guys, it seemed there were just some things a married man learned not to be honest about with his wife, his abiding love of and even need for porn and sex shows being prime examples. I'm just going to skip a little bit more, and then I'll quit, and we can talk. The oddest thing about all this dirty talk and hiding strip club visits from their wives was the absolute reverence with which they spoke about their wives and their marriages. To them, it seemed it was necessary to lie about certain things, but in their minds, this didn't threaten or damage the integrity of their partnerships. They were happy and they cherished their wives. When Jim's wife's second cancer diagnosis came through, he talked about it with us a bit, but only in clipped phrases. He'd spent the previous week drinking himself into a stupor and blowing up abandoned cars on the back lot of a friend's junkyard. You could tell that the news was devouring him, and the only way he could deal with it was to tear himself up and anything else inanimate that was handy. You know, man, he said to me, she puts up with a hell of a lot with me, and I can't say I've ever been unhappy with her. How many guys can say that? I've got a good woman. She's never given me a minute's trouble. And I'm just going to skip to the very end where I give them a little bit of my disclosure, and then we'll... I'd been playing a part with these guys for months, being Ned, the walk-on. Of course, he had it easy in a way because everything was on the surface. Nobody knew him, and he didn't really know anybody else. He was mostly quiet, listening, recording, trying not to say the wrong thing, trying not to give himself away, and that put a barrier between him and his environment. Despite the masculine intimacy that enveloped the evening, the guys and I were really only amenable strangers warming our hands together for a while over the few things we had to say to each other. The odd fag joke or tall tale of glory days, the passing home improvement reference, and of course the ritual dissection of Sunday night football and the ongoing hockey season. Nothing mysterious, really, the usual stuff that guys find convenient to say when nobody's giving anything away. So after having bowled with these guys every Monday night for 6 months, I gave something away. I just decided one night that it was time to tell them. But how to do it? I didn't know. I was wary, uncertain about how to come clean. I couldn't anticipate how they'd react. I had visions of myself running down the middle of the town's main street with my shirt ripped off at the shoulder and a lynch mob chasing me with brick bats and bowling balls in hand. Fortunately, that night, Jim presented me with the perfect opportunity. He asked me what I was doing after we finished, something he'd never done before, so I took a chance and asked him to have a drink with me. He was the most accessible of the bunch, and I figured getting him alone and telling him first would give me a sense of how things would proceed, if at all. We went to his favorite haunt, a biker bar not far from the trailer park where he lived. When we sat down at the bar, I told him he should order a shot of whatever would relax him the most, because he was going to need it. "I think I'm about to blow your mind," I said. "I doubt it," he said. "Just about the only thing you could say that would blow my mind is if you told me that your girlfriend was really a man and you were really a woman." "Well," I said, stunned by his exactitude, "you're half right." "Okay," he said slowly, peering at me skeptically. "In that case, I'll have a blackberry brandy with a beer back. Actually," I said, "you might want to. I'm buying." He downed the first and ordered another. I wasn't sure if he was spooked or just taking advantage of the freebies. Knowing him, probably the latter. Not that I was the big spender or anything. At that bar, you could get good and ripped for $10. When he'd wiped the vestiges of the second shot off his lips, I started in. "Jim," I said, "you were right. I'm not a guy. I'm a woman." "Shut up, asshole," he said. "Come on, really. What did you want to tell me?" "No, that's really it. I'm a woman. Look," I said, "I'll show you my driver's license if you don't believe me." I pulled it out of my wallet and put it into his hand. He looked at it for a second and then said, "That doesn't even look like you." He shoved it back into my hand. "Besides, you can fake those easy." "I swear, Jim, it's not a fake. That's me. My name is Nora, not Ned." "Shut up," he said again. "Why are you doing this to me? I mean, I gotta hand it to you. If this is a joke, it's a good one. You got me, but a joke's a joke." "It's not a joke, Jim." He shook his head and took a big gulp of his beer. "Okay, look," I said, "I'll show you every card in my wallet, including my Social Security card. They all have the same name on them." I put all the cards on the bar in a row where he could see them. He looked at them all cursorily and then said, "Are you fucking with me? Because if you are, this is fucked up. I mean, if I'd thought of it first, I'd have done it to you. But shit, you gotta tell me." "No," I said, "I swear to God, I'm not fucking with you. I'm a woman. My name is Nora. Look, I don't have a protruding Adam's apple, right?" I put his finger on my throat and ran it up and down. "I'm wearing a tight sports bra to hold down my tits," I said, putting his hand on my back so he could feel the straps under my sweatshirt. "Look, if you still don't believe me, let's go in the bathroom and I'll show you." "No, thanks," he blurted, jerking away from me. "I don't want to see that shit." "Jesus, man, you're fucking me up. And you were my coolest guy friend, too." "Damn it, this is really blowing my mind. You better not be fucking with me." It took a while to get him to concede it, even remotely, and every once in a while he'd still say, "You're not fucking with me, are you?" But we sat there for a good 3 hours talking about the book and why I was doing it, and slowly I got the sense that it was sinking in. "I gotta say," he said finally, "that takes balls, or not, I guess." "Wow, you're a fucking chick. No wonder you listen so good." We went through the whole rigmarole of hindsight, things he'd thought were a little odd at the time, but now made sense to him. We'd have long moments of silence, and then he'd say something like, "So that's why you always wear a sweatshirt, even though it's so hot in there, right? It's to cover up your tits." "Yep," I'd say, "it sucks, too, because I sweat my ass off." We'd lapse back into silence for a while, and then he'd say, "That's why your lips and your cheeks are so red." I always noticed that and thought it was weird. That was his way of saying I had a nice complexion, I think. Nicer, at least, than all the leather faces in the league. But for the most part, it seemed I'd pulled off Ned pretty well, because there weren't that many things Jim could look back on with recognition. In the end, he just said, "That stubble is really good, man. I just thought it was exactly what I'd have at the end of the day." That was satisfying. When we left the bar that night, he hugged me goodnight. It was the first evidence that he had accepted me, or at least some part of me, as a woman. He was still calling me he, which was understandable, but I knew that he wouldn't have come within a mile of Ned physically if he hadn't seen the woman in him. Some part of the truth was getting through. But I was still in drag, and as we hugged, we both realized it. Jim said, "Shit, you don't want to be seen hugging another man in the parking lot of a bar like this." He pulled away quickly as we parted ways toward our cars. He shouted over his shoulder, "Hey man, you take care of yourself over there in Iraq, okay?" When we reached our cars, I shouted back to him, "Hey, Jim." When he turned around, I pulled up my sweatshirt and my sports bra and flashed him the telltale tit. "See, I told you so." He winced and turned away. "Jesus, you fucking freak. I don't want to see that shit. You still got your beard on." He shouted it like a slur, but I could hear the laughter in his voice. Anyway, I'll leave it there. I'm going to get a backache in this podium for midgets, but anyway. So, please ask away if you have questions, if you're not stunned by the vulgarity.
So which one taught you more about working as a guy? Was it Red Bull or hanging with the bowling guys?
They taught me different stuff. You know, the Red Bull thing taught me a lot about working, the working world, and sort of the expectations of, you know, that a guy can't fail in the workplace and that it's still very much about kind of tied to your genitalia in a way, and you're kind of impugned as a man if you don't succeed in the workplace in a way that women aren't. But the bowling thing taught me a lot more about the way that men are with each other intimately. I didn't read that passage, but there were some amazing moments of learning about the way that men make friends and the way that they communicate with each other, which from a woman's point of view seems, you know, I said it's sort of like hearing sounds that only dogs can hear, but it really is like a different language, and it was a real education to sort of at least partly partake and at least observe that. So it was just very different.
Thanks.
Hi.
Could you tell me how your experience has shaped the way you are in the world today and how you interact with both men and women?
Sure. I think certainly, you know, with men, it's sort of inescapable that I would have greater sympathy for them and kind of understand more. Going into it, I think I had that feeling that a lot of women have, that men have it better in every way. And I think what I learned coming out of it is that there are male advantages and there are female advantages, and they're just different. And there are male problems and female problems, and they're different. So I think I'm able to sort of understand the struggles of men a little bit better, and I don't purport to say that I'm carrying the flag of masculinity in that way, but just to say that maybe I get a little bit of an insight. And I think it does help in, especially I would say in my relationships with, you know, intimate relationships like with my father and my brothers, and just sort of understanding a little bit more rather than, for example, interpreting, you know, maybe their different way of communicating as a kind of an unwillingness. I see it more as a product of their upbringing and a kind of way of being socialized not to communicate emotionally, and that in some ways it's an unrealistic expectation on my part to want them to sort of bring up this or be fluent in an emotional vocabulary that they were sort of teased and beaten out of in adolescence in many cases. So then with women, I think, you know, as much as I was able to see men from the inside a little bit, I was also able to see my own sex from the outside. And I think I was able to see that we have more power than we know. You know, I think a lot of the feminist conversation has been about being the second sex or being sort of the underlings. And certainly there's a lot of truth in that, but there's also a lot of truth in realizing that when I dated women as a man, it was really kind of an exercise in female power. And as I mentioned, realizing how much the esteem of women means to men. And I think they don't, particularly from their point of view, they don't necessarily feel like they're on top of the situation. So that's kind of, in some ways, good news. So just various things. I guess a more balanced view of both sexes maybe than I had before. Yeah.
I'm intrigued. Having seen you just briefly on, you know, national TV and everything, I'm curious, in making the flip to playing a role going on national TV and everything, did you feel like you had to portray yourself in a different way? Because, like, your energy here is much different than, like, on CNN and everything. And do you feel like you had to straighten up and play a role to be perceived? What's your experience with
that? Yeah, totally. It's a very shrewd question. Both of those pictures on the cover are drag. So, and, you know, I'm a media whore. What can I say? But, yeah, I mean, you get put through the grinder of the media and what the media can accept. And, you know, I'm not acceptable as I am, which is what you see before you, which is somewhere right smack in the middle between Ned and Nora. So, yeah, I mean, and it's been an interesting experience to kind of run through the mill of that and continually get the message that you're not feminine enough for the contrast, or, you know, being a lesbian somehow, you know, changes the project, that kind of thing. So I think it was sort of a reinforcing of that sense of distance that I feel that, you know, you are not part of the larger culture, and not just because I'm gay, but because I'm androgynous. And so, yeah, I mean, all that media stuff, that's not me. I mean, I don't know that anybody's ever really him or herself in media encounters, because it's just a circus, and it's sort of insulting, you know. It's sort of like, you really expect me to show you myself? You know, I'm not going to do that. So, yeah, that's kind of what happens. Good question, though.
Was there a big difference in reviews for the book, whether the reviewer was a man or a woman?
Yeah, I guess fairly often. I mean, that wasn't always true, certainly, but I was more inclined to get a kind of a negative reaction. I mean, I think actually Joyce Carol Oates reviewed it for the Times Literary Supplement, and she said that she sort of commented on some quotation that I'd had and said, in other words, all women are bitches. And I don't really think that's what I was saying. But, you know, I think what happened, and that's another way where you learn how things get digested in the media, that if you dare, I mean, I think we're big girls at this point. You know, feminism has succeeded to the point where we can take a little criticism and we can look at ourselves and say, okay, well, that's not the most attractive thing that we tend to do. And I think that also daring to sort of praise men a little bit and talk about male virtue is just something that doesn't get done very often. So there are groups of people who sometimes respond to that in a very vitriolic way, although I did really avoid most of my reviews because I find them kind of unpleasant, and I guess I have a pretty thin skin. So I'm not sure about that, but I certainly have been accused of being a misogynist after writing this book, and I guess what I tell people is that I really hate everybody, so equal opportunity despiser.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi.
I was just wondering, I didn't see it when I was reading the information, but where did you do this? Where did you do this?
I did it all over the country, and I didn't talk about the states because I really wanted to try to disguise things as much as possible, especially in the monasteries case. You know, there aren't that many monasteries in any given state. So, but I was in the Southwest, I was in the Midwest, I was in the Northeast, several states in the Northeast. I didn't make it to the West Coast, but I did a fairly good range of things.
Were they like in the cities or in the rural areas? Or?
Yeah, different places. And
okay.
There were certainly different, as you might expect, In the urban coastal areas, you tend to find a more fluid, you know, version of what's acceptably masculine, although I still found it quite strict. And then, of course, yeah, as you get into more rural areas or the so-called heartland, it becomes even more rigid what's acceptable. And unfortunately, I didn't, you know, people have asked me, well, you know, like, I was going to do a gay chapter, for example, and the monastery chapter ended up being the gay chapter. but also, I mean, I wanted to do something with race, actually, and I think it probably would have been too broad to try to encompass in one book, but people have criticized me, and I think that's probably right, that it's a different kettle of fish, I would imagine. And so I kind of had to limit it to sort of white males in America, and that is limited. You know, I admit that. That's true.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
I was just wondering if there are any ramifications for publishing the book, because you said you made it as anonymous as possible, but were the people that you chose not to tell, I suppose they would be like, hey, that was me.
Well, most of the people, you know, have read the book, and most of the major characters, and really been good sports about it. I mean, I think they felt that I accomplished something good and I reflected their communities fairly. I've only heard from one of the women that I dated, and I know that one of them I didn't portray particularly, I don't know, graciously maybe. And, you know, I sort of keep waiting for her to pop out of the woodwork. But you know, there's always that threat they tell you, you know, that somebody can sue you for emotional abuse or some such. But that hasn't happened yet, so I'm, you know, crossing my fingers and sort of saving my notebooks in case I need to go to court. But I'm really hoping that doesn't happen. So, yeah, I mean, the reception has actually been quite good. And you know, like the monks, one of the monks who since become the abbot of the monastery read it and really felt like, you know, was faithful to what I experienced. And one of the guys in the men's group, I finally did disclose myself to him, and he seemed very, you know, I guess happy to see that I'd maybe gotten a little something of what they were trying to do, even though I was making fun of it a little bit too. I was also saying, you know, I think you're doing something valuable. So overall, it was good.
Can you talk a little bit about what it was like kind of moving through the world anonymously as Ned versus anonymously as Nora, and how you were received by people in, like, you know, restaurants or gas stations, if you noticed a difference, like subtle differences between being a man?
Well, at first I didn't. And that's part of the reason why I put myself in these specific situations, kind of controlled environments, because I wanted to elicit more responses and better material. But then as I got to understand those differences better, I would find that, you know, like later on in the process, for example, for the media, for the 2020 thing they did, I went in with hidden cameras to like a Home Depot and, you know, asked for an electrical socket as a man and a woman. And it was interesting, you know, like the guy would talk to you like he assumed you knew what he was talking about if you were a guy, and, you know, a level of competence and so on. And, you know, like you were an idiot if you were a woman, you know, sort of like you really have no idea what you're doing. I mean, sort of predictable things, or, you know, going into it by a car, I did that. And, you know, different ways of speaking to you. So, I mean, I did find that almost invariably there were gendered kind of codes to the way that people treated me. And what was most interesting is that in my regular life, a lot of times people are not really quite sure whether I'm a man or a woman, depending on where I am in the country. And that tells you a lot more, because they're incredibly uncomfortable because they don't know how, they don't know what script to adopt, you know, because they don't know what you are. And so that discomfort actually tells you a lot about how necessary that category is. So, and I just think it's interesting, though, that, you know, no dog is ever mistaken about anybody's sex. You know, I guess if we went around sniffing each other, we'd be a little sure about it.
Hello.
Hey.
I'm just wondering if you, like, sort of studied any acting techniques before this, and if this is your Ned voice, or if you changed your voice for Ned.
Ned's a little more down here. No. Yeah, Ned's like, you know, a few brandies and a few cigars later, and kind of, it's kind of like, you know, the Exorcist voice. No. I didn't really do much. I did a little bit of acting coaching, but I grew up in an acting family, and I spent a lot of time as a kid around the theater, and I didn't really inherit that facility. I just was never very good at it. So I'm not sure I did a particularly good acting job. I think it really was more a question of psychological conviction, like that people, you know, the costume initially would make people believe that I was who I was saying I was. But then beyond that, you know, there were times when I didn't even wear my beard later in the time, you know, like when I stayed at the monastery for 3 weeks, by the end of the time, I wasn't wearing it anymore. And I realized that it became very much a psychological projection. So it wasn't even so much about what my voice sounded like, or, you know, whether I had the correct mannerisms. It was really more about, you know, had I convinced you, and could I maintain that, you know, conviction, I guess.
Have you seen the movie Borat? And if so, what did you think of it, and what he revealed by pretending to be someone he wasn't?
Well, that's interesting, actually, because I remember thinking at the time that, you know, I don't know how he went about doing those things and getting permission to use them, because you do usually have to use permission. And it's an interesting thing to think about, you know, for me, the ethical question of if you're going to, I mean, I was careful about this. Like, I didn't want to humiliate anybody, even though they were anonymous. I didn't feel that it was helping any situation to really humiliate people. Whereas clearly that seems to be what he's after, to really kind of, and I think it's pretty easy to, I mean, I love that movie and I think he's hilarious, I really do, but I also think it's pretty easy, it would be pretty easy to embarrass me if, you know, if you were asking the right questions in a certain kind of mode. I'm sure it would be easy to embarrass a lot of us. So I guess I do take issue a little bit with his method, because it does seem to sort of be, it is very entertaining and it's funny, and it certainly tells you that you scratch any part of America and you very quickly come to anti-Semitism and homophobia. And there's a certain value in knowing that, but On the other hand, I don't know, I did have a squeamishness about it, and I thought, I'd like to think there's a categorical difference that I'm between me and him in that sense. You know, but it is something you consider, and it was something that followed me throughout the project, was this constant sense of the ethical question of deceit and how do you justify that deceit. And I like to hope that the book did enough that was serious and was well-intentioned enough that it justifies, especially given that I'm the only person who isn't anonymous. So I guess that's where I come out on it.
Hi, my partner is a transgender man, and I've been with him when he was a woman and through the transition, and I'm just interested to hear what conversations you've had with transgender people about your book and what reactions you've gotten and your thoughts.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting in part, I think, you know, I say a lot that my experience was almost the opposite, I think, of what transgender people, at least the books that I've read, that people I've spoken to, that they report that in their original life, in their preoperative state, that they feel very alienated. And then when they are first sort of, when they transition and they are seen as a member of the opposite sex, they feel that they come into their own. And mine was really kind of the reverse experience, where I did feel, you know, whatever freak I actually am in my real life, you know, I kind of live there and that's okay. But then going into being a man felt really alienating. So I look at it as kind of, I did it in reverse, in a sense, to what they do. I haven't talked to them about that particularly, but that's the way I look at it and talk about it. And I have had some people who've, you know, I had an irate caller on a radio show the other day who said, you know, yours is a very, you know, incomplete, invalid experience because you didn't take hormones and you were just sort of, I mean, I think some of them may think that I was usurping their territory or something, you know, I think for me it was important to emphasize that the disguise was just a methodology. It wasn't something that was central to my sense of self or self-development. And that certainly is a big difference, I think, between. Does that help? Or, I don't know, you seem like there's more that you want to.
I have to think a little more, so
okay.
I'll catch you later.
Okay.
Did you read the book Black Like Me before and after, and how does how that book ends compared to your experiences?
Well, you know, it's similar in the sense that I think he just felt, you know, I think he goes at one point when he decides to end it, he ends it sort of abruptly, and he goes into a public bathroom and he wipes the stuff off and he sort of does the best that he can to just get out of the experience, and that's sort of what happened to me. I mean, I didn't, not just taking the makeup off, but just my brain just kind of shut down, and I think that we shared that sense of this is really awful. Of course, he had much more reason to feel that it was awful given the degradation that he endured. But one thing that I thought was very different, and I did read it before I started to write the proposal, and I guess the difference was that his was a much more superficial kind of trip. You know, he did it really for only a few weeks. And I sort of envied the ease in a way, because he could walk down the same street in the South or go to the same restaurant or not be able to eat in the same restaurant and very quickly, or ride on the bus, get a very obvious response that was different that he could report. And for me, that's part of the reason why I chose the more the circumstances that I sort of set up for myself, because I found that just walking down the street, and this partially answers another question that came before about treatment by salespeople and so on. I mean, those cues are pretty subtle, and you have to interpret them much more. It's harder, which is why I think there is a lot of interpretation in the book. There's a sense of teasing out what happened in my experience and trying to let you know what my take on it was, but there's no way to sort of have it as categorical as you can or cannot eat in this restaurant or you must sit at the back of the bus. So I kind of envied him the ease of that sort of reportage, but on the other hand, he put himself in much greater danger than I did in many ways. So, but those were certainly my models. You know, Barbara Ehrenreich similarly, although again, I envied them because they didn't really get themselves into situations where they were becoming intimate with people, where I did that, and so then there was that sort of onus of guilt about, you know, doing that and ingratiating myself to people while, you know, being an imposter.
Hi.
Hi.
You mentioned being an imposter. I wonder if you learned anything about deceit through this protracted lie, basically, its effect on you and sort of how you lived your life.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think on the one hand, of course, just knowing that I could never do it again. I mean, I think you probably have to kind of be a sociopath to really not have felt bad about it at all or to have disappeared into the character. But on a deeper level, I think what I ended up feeling is that this book was, in a way, the experience that I had and the kind of breakdown that I had in the end was mirroring what I think is true of gender roles in general. And this book ended up being really a book about the self more than about male and female roles, but the self's relation to those roles and the ways in which those roles truncate the self or box in the self, and that the self is a pretty idiosyncratic kind of creature. And that my feeling in the end was that wherever it is that you live, most of us live somewhere outside, or we have little bits of us that are outside the norms. And it would be, I think, a better world if we could all sort of find a way to accommodate, and certainly this has been more true for women in the post-feminist age, but men too, to accommodate both the masculine and feminine sides of ourselves that I think we all have, and to stay as true to ourselves, that's the sort of the primary task, rather than what we tend to focus most of our energy on, which is fitting in and belonging and doing what's expected of us, which is much more toxic to your emotional well-being, I think.
First, thank you for your work.
Oh, thank you.
And my question is, having transitioned to being a male, if a group of young women came to you and said, how do I succeed as a woman in a male-dominated field, industry, or organization, having switched that role, what would you tell them? What advice would you give them how to succeed?
Well, I think the best thing that we still probably could borrow, I mean, the remaining biggest male advantage that I found was, quoting a line from Hamlet, that nothing is either bad or good, but thinking makes it so. And I think there is a way in which, another way I described it was that the culture takes you as a man and symbolically sort of says, we're going to tear your heart out. You know, we don't want to know about your emotional life. We don't want to see your weakness, but we're going to give you legs and a VIP pass to make up for it. So it's sort of like, we're going to march you through to the front of the line and we're going to expect you to get going. And I think there is a way that men do compensate for the inability to show those weaknesses with a kind of a, sometimes an arrogance and sometimes a sense of, I called it sort of billy club confidence. I mean, I think that gets you incredibly far. And I think that goes a long way toward explaining some of the differences that you still see in the, you know, in the so-called glass ceiling and in the workplace, that we could borrow from men that sense of just kind of putting away, you know, it's like that New Yorker cartoon that I find so funny, that, you know, the difference between men and women is that, you know, the man tries on the pants and he says, you know, they're too small, and he says, there's something wrong with these pants, and the woman tries them on and she says, I've got to lose some weight, you know, and it's like that difference. And I think that is true. I mean, I think that's what I was saying. There are disadvantages to being male, and one of those, the flip side of that advantage is that sort of terrible hole at the center of you, or that inability to express yourself. I mean, if you're lucky, maybe you get to do it with your wife, but certainly in a lot of situations you don't. And but the positive side is that kind of marching order. And so I would say, you know, if you can borrow that you know, thinking makes it so, or the Nike thing, just do it. I think it goes a long way.
You've touched on this a little bit already, but the reaction, especially among feminist elements, the labeling of you as a misogynist, so on and so forth, I was very struck when I read your book about the tone of sympathy towards, which I took as a tone of sympathy towards men, towards maleness. And so that sort of raises two questions for me. One is, was that a conscious decision on your choice, on your part, to tell that side of the story, as opposed to other sides of the story that perhaps have been told at other times? And then the second question is there something about you, your personality, your upbringing, that makes you better able to see that or tell that side of the story than other writers who maybe, in all fairness, have told a more balanced, or at least told the other side of the story.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think part of me did feel that the conversation has been dominated by a kind of a feminist anger, and I think that somewhat a vilifying of the male, and I think there was a part of me that wanted to say, you know, there are ways of looking at this that, you know, the so-called male privileges may not be entirely privileges in the way that we think of them. And I do think also I felt that I guess I couldn't help it. I felt that I really began to really care about the people around me and the experience that I had. When you do this, when you take on the persona of another group of people, I mean, part of what happens invariably is that you become more sympathetic to their way of viewing things. But I guess for me, ultimately, it felt like a way to move the conversation forward would be to say, okay, to accept all the feminist literature that's come before and say, okay, these are acceptable complaints, absolutely valid. But what about the other side, that there are two roles in the patriarchy and two of them that are strict in their own ways and each were roles. It just seemed like a new way of framing it that might sort of ignite a new and different conversation, because it does seem as though the conversation has been stalled. But also, I mean, I do think that as much as I do criticize women, I also do, and I do show sympathy for men, I do show men at their worst. I mean, some of the strip club and the work chapter that I didn't read. I mean, you do see, you know, I do kind of capture men at their worst as well. So I try to have some balance there anyway.
I had two questions, I guess. One was, what did you find most interesting? And then another one was, what surprised you the most? I guess it could be general, just whatever you thought, whatever you take from those two questions.
Well, I think the most interesting thing for me was learning those kind of silent rules of human behavior, and it's really hard to learn those unless you are living in the skin of this person. I mean, so for me it was sort of like going to a foreign country or changing the frequency and suddenly all kinds of things pop out of the background that you didn't even notice before. That was really fascinating to me, to kind of change my perspective on my own culture and my own everyday world in such a way that the usually mundane was suddenly fascinating to me, and that there are these silent rules that we all kind of live by, and a lot of, I mean, obviously there are many of them related to various parts of life, whether it be race or class and so on, but sex is certainly a big part of it. And in terms of the biggest surprise, I guess it really was this idea that that men are, that there are, you know, the sort of the male complaint doesn't seem to have been as much a part of the conversation as I would like to see it be, at least in not in a kind of Portnoy's complaint way, but in a kind of more a sense of, hey, you know, this traditional system hasn't always been a picnic for us either. And learning that, because I really did go into it thinking, oh, you know, everything about my life is going to be better as a guy and easier. And so to sort of be humbled by that and realize, oh, you know, this isn't altogether so easy in every way, that was probably the most surprising thing. Okay.
Coming in, being a gay woman and being more on the androgynous side and everything, do you think you had it easier? Could other people have, could like a straight woman have done what you did? And also coming out, now how do you approach as a gay woman in the community? How do you look at having been in and gone through this experience? How do you approach, you know, the world now? Do you look at it differently?
Well, I mean, I'm sorry, I lost the first half of the question. As a gay woman, oh, that a straight woman could write. I think you'd have a much harder time. I mean, I think one of the advantages that I had is that I am already fairly masculine for a woman, so it was easier for me, and I had the features and the height and so on to pull it off, and I think it would be harder, although there are women certainly who could do it, and it's always easier for women to transition in that direction than for guys to go in the other direction. In terms of, I mean, having changed my relationship to the world, oddly enough, I think it has separated me more, because partly because of the reception of the book, because I think it sort of made me realize that I saw this as a kind of a reaching out and saying, you know, hey, let's try to understand each other a little better. And I think I kind of got smacked on the hand a little bit, and it became clear that, no, you're a freak, and, you know, you did something really freaky. And even though people kind of, you know, there's been some understanding, I think a lot of it also was I was disappointed by the reception, I guess, because I thought it seemed like people just were too frightened. I guess I thought we were farther along than that, you know, that things people wouldn't be so easily frightened by the idea of someone being in drag and not really even knowing what the book is about at bottom. So that's just made me maybe a little bit more, feel a little bit more estranged, oddly enough, than I did before.
Did you find there? Did you find that there were actually people who would treat you the same regardless of whether they knew whether you were male or female? And as sort of a related question, is that even desirable to have a society where gender roles aren't so high up there and just kind of lower down as just a part of you as opposed to the mm-hmm. thing that people notice first?
Well, I mean, I suppose it might be desirable to have a more human approach to it in the sense that it not being so definitive, but whether it's really possible, I don't even really think it is. I mean, it's like any element of progressive politics where you're trying to overcome prejudice and categories that the human brain works within. And I think it's nice to try for it, but I'm not sure we're going to be entirely successful, especially given that sex is biological in part and that gender is clearly influenced by sex and biochemistry and so on. So. But I still do hope that there would be greater, and we have made strides in a kind of a greater latitude and fluidity in those things. And I mean, for my part, it would be nice to feel like someone actually judges me as a human being rather than, you know, what they see in front of them and the whole host of judgments they bring along with that. But of course, I do it too. I mean, we all do it. It's hard to escape. And so you catch yourself doing it and you think, you know, I really shouldn't be doing that. And yet that's part of how we organize our world, you know, that's our brains function in categories. So I think it's going to be difficult. Well, thank you all for coming. Thanks very much.